May it please the court, Mr. Miller. My name is Mike Morley. I represent the defendant and appellant owner's insurance company in this case. And I would like to reserve approximately 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Well, you have to monitor your own time because if you don't sit down, it will elapse.
I understand. I just want to preface my remarks, Your Honors, by saying that we live in a dangerous world today. In North Dakota, I think the percentages are 50, perhaps north of 50, that automobile accidents are alcohol related. So I don't believe there's any question or issue with the fact that sober designated drivers play a very, very important role in our society today. There are just too many drivers driving impaired and intoxicated, too many accidents that result from impaired drivers. And it's our position in this case that what the district court has now done twice, and this is the second appeal to this court of the same case, it's our position, Your Honors, that what the district court has done in this case is penalize a sober designated driver, Samantha Denault, and punish her for trying to be careful and get people home or back to their place of residence and where they wanted to continue partying safely. And the court has, in fact, rewarded twice now bad choices and bad decisions of a young, intoxicated woman, Amy Hiltner. And as this court knows, as I just mentioned, this case is the second appeal of this action. This court heard the first appeal in Hiltner versus Owners Insurance Company, 869 F3rd 699. It was filed in August 29th of 2017. And this court vacated the district court's judgment on appeal at that time and held that the district court improperly applied a heightened duty of care to the sober designated driver, Samantha Denault. And
but this time the district court expressly said, that's not what I'm doing and I'm relying on the facts. So now where are we? Are we just to, is there some other application of the fault under North Dakota law that's in erroneous, or are we just looking at a factual determination?
Well, and I have a lot of respect for Judge Erickson. I want to say that. I knew him as a litigator. I appeared before him when he was a state district judge. I appeared before him a number of times when he was federal district judge, and he's now a member of your bench. And I realized that Judge Erickson said at conclusion two, in his conclusions in this case, that Denault was the only person in the group that was sober. However, his decision is not influenced by her status as a sober designated driver. But Judge Erickson goes on to state at conclusion three, Denault assumed an ordinary care to protect her passengers from foreseeable harm. Denault's fault was greater than any of the passengers due to the following. This is conclusion 10C. She had the greatest ability to assess danger. Now, I know what Judge Erickson said in his conclusions, that he was not apportioning or basing his decision on fault by Samantha Denault's status as a sober designated driver. But I believe a fair reading of Judge Erickson's conclusions has to lead to the inescapable conclusion that he still was factoring that status of Samantha Denault in when he apportioned fault, because this court reversed, vacated, and the case was sent back down to Judge Erickson. It was not retried. He was simply ordered to make new findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Well, I think we left it up to the district court how to handle it, but that's what the court ended up
doing. And
that's
what But what the district court did the second time, Your Honors, was assess the exact same percentages of fault against the three principal participants in this incident, namely Samantha Denault, Amy Hiltner, and Joshua Jeffrey, that he did the first time. He did not change the percentage of fault one iota.
Did he change any of the other factual findings?
Well, he made
significant in your view.
And again, with all due respect to Judge Erickson, they are not significant. I believe from a fair reading of Judge Erickson's conclusions and findings, he still makes the specific findings that Samantha Denault was the only sober person. And I think 10C, conclusion 10C, Your Honors, and that's, I believe, at addendum 22 of our opening brief, Judge Erickson states that Denault's fault was greater than any of the passengers due to the following 10C. She had the greatest ability to assess danger, i.e., she was the only sober one in the group. I think a fair reading of Judge Erickson's conclusions and findings after remand still lead to the inescapable conclusion that he did unduly factor in Ms. Denault's status as a sober designated driver when apportioning her fault.
Are there two things there, though? There, she had the greatest ability to assess danger. Could that, is that just maybe going to the fact that she's the only sober one? And then there's another, I think, just a little twist, a sober designated driver. Are those two different things?
Not in this case, because she was sober and the driver. She was the sober designated driver. The two go hand in hand. And I don't think you can separate them in this case. So when Judge Erickson points out that Denault was the only sober person in the group, and he also points out Amy Hiltner was intoxicated, Joshua Jeffries was intoxicated, and then he goes on to say Denault had the greatest ability to assess the danger. Again, I think we're right back to where we were on the first appeal from this court, that his conclusions were unduly influenced by Ms. Denault's status as a sober designated driver. And again, I know this court will give deference to Judge Erickson, and I know he said what he said, but it's our position that from the reading of his conclusions that one has to arrive at that inescapable conclusion that he still factored that into the fault apportionment, that Ms. Denault was the only sober one and she was a designated driver in the case. We're also contending that the judgment is not supported by the greater weight of the evidence, and so we're asking for a reversal and a remand on that basis as well, not simply on the status of Ms. Denault as a designated driver, but we're also contending that based upon the facts of the case, that the facts simply do not support an assessment of fault on the part of Ms. Denault of almost three times that of the plaintiff, Amy Hiltner. And this court, I believe, is well aware of the facts from the first appeal, and we've laid them out exhaustively in our brief, but essentially this group was at a party that started out in Mayville, North Dakota, at about 8 o'clock one night. Ms. Denault drove that group over to an apartment owned by the name of a gentleman named Big Red. And I think Big Red is Ethan Brooks, so it's kind of an innocuous name. But over to Big Red's, they were at Big Red's for a few hours, left the party at Big Red's at about midnight, 12:30. This was Ms. Denault's car. She owned it. She got in the driver's seat at Big Red's as she had earlier at Lone Wolf's when they went over to Big Red's. And there were seven people in the group. Five got in the car, three in the front seat, including the driver, Ms. Denault, two in the back seat. Xavier Lone Wolf and Amy Hiltner both got onto the trunk of the car. They knew it was going to be driven and moved because they were going back to Ms. Lone Wolf's apartment following the Big Red's party. Ms. Denault told Amy Hiltner, get off the trunk, get inside the car. Others in the group told Amy Hiltner the same thing, get in the car, we're going back to Lone Wolf's. She refused, and she said, no, it's going to be fine. And they were on the back, the two of them on the back, having a good time, taking selfies watching their hair blow in the wind. They were drinking alcohol, and there was music from the inside of the car, and they were actually swaying. Their backs were seated to the back window of the vehicle, and they were actually swaying to the music as they were driving. And there weren't any issues from the first three turns from Big Reds back to Lone Wolves until that fateful fourth turn when Joshua Jeffries, who I've categorized, and I have no shame in doing that, I've categorized Mr. Jeffries as a cruel, malicious, drunken passenger. On that fourth turn, he didn't grab a part of any of the vehicle, but he pushed down on Ms. Denault's right leg, and that caused the accelerator to speed up around that fourth corner, causing Ms. Denault and Xavier Lone Wolf to be ejected from the trunk of the car, and they were injured. So it's our position, Your Honor, that not only did Judge Erickson continue to apply a heightened improper duty on Ms. Denault as a designated sober driver, but under the facts of this case, they simply do not justify or bear out an assessment of liability on Ms. Denault of three times that of Amy Hiltner, who had the last clear chance. There was room inside the car. She was told to get in the car. No one forced her to sit out on the trunk. She had the last clear chance to get inside that car in a safe position. She chose the position that got her hurt in the end. And according to the evidence, Ms. Denault was doing everything right. She was going slow, approximately 15 miles per hour, slower around curves. She was constantly looking in the rearview mirror back at the two young women sitting on the trunk to make sure that they were okay. She was sober. She was driving fine. She was driving carefully. She didn't want them there, but they chose to put themselves there in a place of danger, and only because of the cruel act of Mr. Jeffries on that fourth corner was Ms. Denault and Ms. Lone Wolf ejected from the trunk and caused.
What's the significance of the percentages as a legal matter under North Dakota law? Well, is there some significance of getting Denault over 50%?
Well, there is. There's significance for underinsured motorists. If Amy Hiltner's fault is 50% or higher compared to the combined fault of all persons who contributed to her injury, she has no recovery. So her fault to make any potential recovery in this case has to be less than 50%. I'm not basing my argument necessarily on the workings of the underinsured motorist law, but that would be the effect. If she was 50% or more.
Denault was 45 and Jeffries was 30 and Hiltner was 25, that adds up to 100.
I think that's 100.
That would eliminate recovery. It would just change the total.
It would change
the amounts.
Exactly. You are exactly correct, Your Honor.
What was the insurance company's position as to what the apportionment should be?
Well, we've contended that Ms. Denault should have no liability because she was trying to do everything right. But certainly between Ms. Denault and Ms. Hiltner, Ms. Denault should be the lowest because she was driving carefully. And this court made specific findings in the first appeal that she was driving the vehicle very carefully.
We said in the first appeal, I thought that owners didn't contest that she was at fault to some degree. Was that wrong? Or
I suppose that's not wrong. We do contest that her fault should be enough, though, to obtain a recovery for Ms. Hiltner. So our position.
In other words, you think Hiltner was
50 or
plus
more,
one?
At least 50. At least 50%.
Because that's what you would need to avoid recovery at all.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
But you're not seeking that relief here. You're just seeking what? Want a new trial another?
We're asking for a new trial. And again, Judge Erickson has made findings twice, and you know he's now full time on the Eighth Circuit.
You want a new trial,
new judge, yeah,
and you want to make a new apportionment argument,
exactly,
in a new proceeding,
exactly. And I've got about 25 seconds
left. All
right,
you may reserve that if you wish.
And thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from Mr. Miller.
May it please the court, counsel. This is kind of.
Why don't we wait till you get up to the microphone here so we can hear?
Sorry, sir. May it please the court and counsel. A new argument raised today by Mr. Morley. Ignore Judge Erickson's opinion. He wants you to read tea leaves or maybe chicken entrails to see what he was really thinking rather than what he wrote in his opinion, which is pretty clearly that he did not consider Ms. Denault being a designated driver in his fault allocation.
Well, I heard him arguing we should rely on the opinion, and in particular, the findings in paragraph 10C. Paragraph 2 and about how she was the only sober person, and 10C, which says she had the greatest ability to assess danger. So maybe you should address those.
Which indeed she did.
Pardon me?
The North Dakota law.
Which indeed she did.
Have the greater ability to assess the danger, yes.
And why was that?
Because she was not drunk. North Dakota law has...
Why doesn't that just make his case then that the 10C is about the fact that she was sober and she was the only sober person?
No, that's not... We don't ask you to start the clock running from the time that she got into the car and started the car. The time starts to run from the time of her being outside the car with people on her trunk saying, get off the car. I will not start this car. I will not move this car as long as you're there. She didn't do that. She got into the car, and he says she's doing as safely as she can, as long as she can, to get these people to where they need to be. Not true. She's in a hurry to get back to Grand Forks for a booty call. She had total control up to the time that Jeffries pushed on her knee over whether that car moved, at what speed it moved, what route it took, where the passengers sat. North Dakota law has a provision, and I know we've cited it in past briefs. They all kind of meld together now, where voluntary intoxication can be considered in determining whether intent can be arrived at. And that's what I read Judge Erickson bringing that into the discussion, that part of the law that's it's by case law. But going back to his actual conclusions, aside from emphasizing that whether she was designated driver or not had nothing to do with what he decided, he goes on to say that until Jeffrey's interference, she was in exclusive control of the vehicle. And then 10E, he went through each of the individual acts that she could have chosen to perform, which she did not do, which would have prevented this tragedy.
In the district court's opinion, it talks about fault under North Dakota law that includes not only negligence, but also the assumption of risk.
Right.
How would you assess the district court's assessment of the assumption of risk between or among the three people at issue? I don't really see that directly addressed, but maybe you can help me.
My assumption is, and I think it's a logical assumption based on his 55-25-20 allocation, is that she assumed, she being Amy, has 20% responsibility for assuming that risk. Now, whether she fully appreciated the risk,
and I understand the numbers, but I was wondering what were the factual bases that supported that prong of the fault analysis?
Well, and I don't have them right in front of me now, but he did detail what her acts were that put her in that precarious position, that she chose to sit on the trunk and that she assumed the risk of
some
injury.
She declined the requests to get inside the car.
She did that as well.
Yeah.
At which point, then, Ms. Denault, in a hurry to get back to Grand Forks, said, okay, then, I will get into the car, I will start the car, and I will take you back to the other apartment.
So she assumed the risk of what might happen with a group of almost half a dozen intoxicated people.
Indeed. Interestingly, Mr. Morley argued that Amy had the last clear chance to avoid her injury. That's not true. We argued contrary, that the last clear chance to avoid injury would have absolved Amy from whatever fault she had under the old pre-comparative fault days. The last clear chance doctrine is simply if a plaintiff puts herself in a precarious or dangerous position, but the defendant has a chance after that to avoid injury, to avoid the harm, then that supersedes the plaintiff's fault and absolves her of fault prior to the comparative fault days. I think that the basic concepts of last clear chance still apply to this situation.
Can I ask, you have said a couple of times that Denault was in a hurry to get back to another town.
Right.
I know that there was a fact finding that she found it difficult, she was irritated. Is there a particular fact that Judge Erickson found that, and she was in a hurry to get someplace else other than Lone Wolf's apartment?
You know, at this point, after a number of years, I don't know what was in his findings specifically at this moment.
What do you mean after a number of years? I mean, this is an appeal that's before us today.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can read the facts before the oral argument.
And I did indeed. Okay. But whether he specifically mentioned her urgency to get back to Grand Forks or not, I cannot say from memory.
He didn't.
Having referred to
he didn't.
I have
but
no
you
reason
keep
to
bringing
you.
It up as though it's a key fact in the case.
Well, okay.
But if that's not a fact in the case, then do you lose, since that seems to be a key fact for your argument?
No, I'm not saying that it's a key fact. It is a true fact from the transcript. I'm sorry that
well, it's
having
not a finding,
it.
Though. It's
right.
And
I'm sorry for finding it. But I do not consider it a key fact. I consider Rule 52A saying that he ought not be reversed absence an abuse of discretion, and the decision from the Anderson Supreme Court putting an extremely high burden on Mr. Morley to pull that off.
What do you think Denault was supposed to do?
I think Denault should have.
She's volunteered to be the designated driver. She's got four drunk people, and two of them won't get in the car. What's she supposed to do?
I don't know that she volunteered to be the designated driver. Is that in the transcript I'm asking? Or excuse me, is that a finding that he made? I don't know that he made that. That's been the assumption based on the position she occupied. It was her car. She decided to drive. But I see nothing in the transcript, nor do I see anything in the findings, that a discussion was made where she said, okay, I will act as the designated driver for you drunks. Going back to the Anderson decision, as Judge Erickson did indicate in his brief order denying the post-trial relief sought by Mr. Morley again, nothing has changed. He's back again. No new arguments. I'm not going to change anything. Allowing something other than the chicken entrails and trying to decide what Ralph Erickson was really thinking rather than what he said runs afoul of the Anderson case from the Supreme Court.
We're not in
a position, and I challenge this court not to decide that, well, I see things differently than this experienced litigator, state district court judge, federal trial judge saw things when he heard the testimony and saw the parties testify. That Anderson specifically says you're not to substitute your choice as to how you'd like to see this case turn out rather than that of the person who saw the testimony. And it also mentions that that would turn a trial like we had into sort of taking the play out on the road and opening in Providence before you get to Broadway. That's not what this is about. Are you prepared to say that an aggrieved insurance company doesn't like the outcome, they think that it's too much fault on the part of their entity or the person that they are asked to have to indemnify, can come up repeatedly to this court on basically a factual determination? That's going to cause mischief, as the Anderson court said. A duplication of the trial judge's effort in the Court of Appeals would very likely contribute only negligibly to the accuracy of fact determinations and at a huge cost in diversion of judicial resources. Are you prepared to do that? Are you prepared to say that Ralph Erickson was so far wrong that we need to substitute our judgment for him. He went through thoroughly on remand.
I think the argument is that there was a legal error. That was the argument the first time. We agreed with it. You made the same argument the first time. We concluded there was a legal error. And the argument here is that there's still a legal error because of the imposition of a heightened duty on the person who was sober because she was sober and the driver. Now, maybe there's not a legal error. You can argue that, but that's different from arguing second-guessing factual findings.
I am arguing there was not a legal error.
Okay, well, that would be... Why don't you speak to that then for a minute, if you would?
Excuse me, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
If you would speak to that for a minute, because I think that's the primary argument from the company, not that we should second-guess factual findings on a record that includes no legal error. They're arguing legal error.
When the judge who heard the case says specifically he did not consider her status, her claim status as designated driver, I take him at his word. I ask that you take him at his word. When he said that she was more capable than others because she had not been drinking to determine the extent of the danger to her passengers, that's simply a statement of fact. That goes to, as I said, the case law in North Dakota saying that it is permissible for a fact finder, like Ralph Erickson, it is permissible for a fact finder to take a look at voluntary intoxication and determine what role that played and how this played out. And looking at that, as North Dakota law clearly allows him to do, permits him to do, he stated the obvious, that Amy Hiltner was mildly intoxicated. Jeffries was more greatly intoxicated. The opportunities to avoid this catastrophe were throughout the time. After Amy and Lone Wolf jumped on the back of that car, they were in the hands of Ms. Denault throughout that whole time.
And that's where the district court noted that she had the greatest ability to assess the danger. So I think that's where the concern about collapsing sober and designated driver are. You've emphasized some of the facts that preceded getting into the car, but that finding is right there in paragraph 10, where it begins with choosing to start the vehicle and then ends with failing to take adequate measures.
Right. It's a statement of fact. Does that amount to her then being the designated driver? Does that open the door, apparently, for, as Mr. Morley says, rewarding drunks and punishing sober drivers? I don't think so. The facts of this case stand or fall on the facts of this case. When the judge says, I did not take any kind of designated driver designation, real or de facto, into considering this, I'm simply saying, says Judge Erickson, that she had a greater ability to appreciate danger than the others. She did. That's a statement of fact, not a misstatement of the law. So I ask that finally, after some 9-plus years, since she was injured in May of 2010, that you affirm the trial court and then send it back with that affirmance. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Morley, we'll give you 1 minute in rebuttal if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to talk about this business of that Mr. Miller states that Ms. Denault was in a hurry to get back to a, he calls it a booty call. I just turned 66. I'm not sure I'm all that familiar with that term, but I think that's Mr. Miller's phrase for she was in a hurry to get back to Grand Forks, and therefore she drove carelessly. It's not in the record. In fact, the findings in the record at Addendum 17, Finding 49 by Judge Erickson, are, quote, despite Jeffrey's erratic behavior, Denault continued to operate the vehicle at approximately 15 miles per hour when the road was straight and slowed down to make the turns, close quote. Those are the facts. That's and those are not in dispute. And that doesn't sound to me, and I don't think it sounded to this court on the first appeal, that that's someone in a hurry to get back to Grand Forks for a so-called booty call. And I did not argue at the first appeal. My associate did. I believe this same issue came up then, and Mr. Miller was shot down at that time as well. And I'm very surprised that he would try to mislead the court again. Thank you.
All right.